Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you very much for being here, and it's a pleasure and a privilege to offer a little bit of conversation about what some people call the most exegetically debated verse in the Gospel of Matthew. And so, of course, what I'll do today is offer the authoritative solution to all the problems. If you have one of the handouts, I have put the Greek of Matthew 11, verse 12, on the top of the page. You can't just translate it because now you've begged all the questions. I would render it, as you'll see, something like the following. And it's embedded in a paragraph of teaching of Jesus about John the Baptizer, right? There in Matthew 11, I would render it something like this: from the days of John the Baptizer until now, the reign of heaven is being violently attacked, and violent men are trying to snatch it away. But again, just rendering it like that means that you've already made a bunch of exegetical decisions. And so what I hope to do is to survey the lexical data, which is really confusing. It was helpful to me to try to put it at least in a form that early this morning seemed clear. And then to talk a little bit about the very interesting history of interpretation, and finally to come down at a particular place of interpretation. Thankfully, there are not any really significant variant readings, at least not in the handbook or in Ruben Swanson's first volume. And I just noted those there at the top of the page. So let me just, within the time constraints, walk through the data. The biggest problem, perhaps, is the verb in the first clause, and the form, as you can see it, is biazetai. Now, those of you that have studied Greek know that this is an ambiguous form. It could parse as present indicative middle, or it could parse as present indicative passive, third singular in either case. The subject grammatically is the reign of heaven, and then you have this verb form. And then in the second clause, you have the related noun, the biastai, as the subject of another verb that can have different senses, namely harpazo. So let me just walk through the outline with you as it's there. As I mentioned, the verb biazetai can parse as either middle, which is more frequent apparently in Greek literature, or the passive voice, which is also not uncommon. Rarely, apparently, does this verb occur in the active voice in Greek literature. Now, if you parse it as middle, then it can be transitive or intransitive. That is to say, it can take a direct object or not take a direct object. If it has a transitive meaning, then I gave there the basic meanings from Bauer-Danker, Arndt and Gingrich, and Liddell and Scott. It can mean to inflict violence upon, dominate, constrain, overpower by force, or press hard. And I just thought to offer a little bit of data from the Septuagint, the Bible Works database. There are six times in which the middle transitive has a positive sense of urge or constrain in positive context, and eight times with a negative force of force through, fight against, and so forth. Now, the middle voice can also be intransitive, right? In which case, the dictionaries give the meaning of to gain an objective by force, use force, act with violence, or use force. There's one example of the intransitive middle in Exodus 19, verse 28, where it means, in a negative sense, the people are urged not to break through to the mountain lest they be slain by Yahweh. Now, you have to make a decision, I suppose, if you're going to read it as middle. Is it transitive or intransitive? And the fact that there's no object, no direct object, has led most scholars to think, well, if it's middle, then it has an intransitive meaning, which would be 1b. Now, the other option, of course, and I'm glad this is the first paper up because you're not sleepy yet, is that the verb parses as present indicative passive voice, right? In which case, the meanings given by the standard lexica are to be violently treated, to be oppressed, to be hard-pressed or overpowered. Most of the time, not always, but most of the time, this verb, no matter how you parse it, would have a kind of a negative force to it, although it's possible for it to have a positive sense as well. There's an interesting example of, I could only find in the Septuagint one passive voice example where the verb apparently means to be overstuffed with food. So to be assaulted by food. I mean, at which point I'm thinking, whose fault is that? I mean, but now that's the biggest sort of lexical conundrum in the verse is, do you take biadzatai as middle or passive? And in a sense, no matter how you take it, does it have a negative meaning or does it have a positive sense? So does it mean something like, we'll come to that. The other two terms that sort of cry out for examination are the noun in the second half of the verse, biastes. It's not a common word. Those who have studied all the uses tell me, I'm leaning on their work, is that it apparently in Greek literature always means a violent or impetuous person. It's never forceful in the way we would positively use that. So this is a strongly negative term. And of course the verb harpazo can have positive or negative sense. It can mean seize or snatch, like Acts 8:39, which I think is where the Spirit snatches Philip away, but the Ethiopian eunuch continues on his road. Somewhat more commonly, it can mean to snatch away negatively, to plunder, as in Matthew 12, where the stronger man plunders the possessions of the strong man. Now, interestingly, and I think this is of some significance, point D, there have been two, as far as I'm aware, two extensive looks at the combination of terms. So in context where you have a bia stem, either noun or verb, along with harpazo or a harpas stem, there's a scholar named Moore who has some decades ago looked at these terms in Josephus, and more recently the Australian scholar Llewellyn has looked at these combination of terms in financial records, papyri and so forth. When there's a combination of these terms, the evidence sort of moves pretty strongly towards taking them all as negative. They have a negative force to them. So far lexically, you can't actually solve all the problems just by doing the lexical work. But I think there is a tendency, especially with the combination of biadzomai and biastes and harpazo, that would lean towards a negative reading. The interesting thing here, of course, is that one of the most currently widely used English translations, namely the New International Version, does anybody happen to have an NIV with them? What would you be willing to read that out loud, the NIV? See, remarkably, the NIV takes both clauses in a positive sense, lexically in a positive, so forceful, okay. As far as I can tell, this is almost impossible. It's not impossible, but, I mean, the evidence, and again, I'm leaning on the work of others here, just like we all do, this seems very unlikely. I actually thought to do this little paper just because I've heard in the last couple of years, uses of this verse that seem to me almost certainly incorrect. So, now, turning to the history of interpretation, as you can see, I called it an odd story. And here I'm relying on a dissertation, that one of these wonderful dissertations where somebody reads everything that anybody has ever said and tells you what they found. So the history of interpretation has been done by a scholar named Peter Cameron, and you can't check this book out of our library because I have it in my hand. What's really interesting to me is especially the early period, and I've made a few notes here. You can see I called 2A when negative is positive and context disappears. Apparently what happens in the Greek fathers, not quite universally according to Cameron, but pretty close, is that the first half of the verse is essentially ignored, and the problem of biadzatai is simply not addressed at all in the Father. Now, the fathers apparently agree pretty much in taking the lexical impact of the second half, violent men are snatching it or plundering it. They understand that in a negative sense, but it has a positive theological meaning. They apply it to the call to an ascetic lifestyle. In other words, in order to be a true Christian, you have to be violent and plunder your fleshly desires. You have to attack them and destroy them. So apparently this is the most widely found understanding in both the Greek and the Latin fathers of the second half of the verse. Remarkably, this is really interesting to me, there is a form of the verse that appears, again, apparently quite commonly. The fathers, the Greek fathers, will cite the verse like this. Biaston garhe basileia ton uranon kai biastai harpazuzen autain, which loosely translated is, for the reign of the heavens is of the violent, and violent men snatch it. Now that's an interesting Bible verse because they made up the first half. I mean, this is not, you know, this isn't in the Bible, at least in any meaningful sense of the term Bible. So interestingly, again, lexically, almost all the time, the Greek fathers, the words have a negative force, but they give it a positive theological meaning. It's paranetic. It's exhortation to fight against the flesh. And as Cameron says, this reading completely ignores the historical context or the historical connections of the verse in Matthew 11, 12. Now, on the back of the handout, then, the Latin fathers at times follow this ascetic or, it says ascetic, that's a new word I just made up, ascetic or paranetic reading. But some of them, and among them is Chrysostom a little bit later, but his interpretation becomes very influential. They do connect it historically, and they make the verse refer to the Gentiles snatching the kingdom away from the Jews, to whom it, in some sense, rightfully belongs. Again, apparently the focus is largely on the second clause, who are the biastai, and what are they doing? But again, according to Cameron, and I looked this up, you know, there's one volume of Chrysostom's homilies in the Nicene and post-Nicene fathers, and I looked it up this morning, and he does seem to take the second half of the verse to all who approach the reign of heaven, and this is now just the English translation of Chrysostom, with earnestness of mind. Apparently, this reading is the most influential one among the 16th century reformers, including Luther. You can find this understanding in Luther himself. According to Cameron, the medieval period apparently offers little new, but it is important, again, I think, to note that the older commentators, for whom at least the Greeks would have a more natural feel for the language, they understand the terms almost exclusively as negative, not as positive in their meaning. In the Reformation and post-Reformation period, apparently Chrysostom's reading is the dominant one. That is, Jesus here, especially in the second half of the verse, is talking about the earnestness with which a believer is to try to snatch, in a positive sense, the reign of heaven and its blessings. But there are apparently two new readings that emerge. I'm very happy to point out that I think Andreas Karlstadt is right. I can't remember the last time that's probably been said in this room. But that's actually ultimately where I think I come out, along with a lot of other modern commentators. He apparently is the first one to suggest that the verse refers primarily to the scorn, derision, and hostility with which Jesus was met by his contemporaries. And there are a few, apparently, that follow his reading, although it does not become influential until the modern sort of post-Enlightenment 19th, 20th century period. Melanchthon is, the great classicist, of course, is apparently the first to clearly take biazitai as a middle form with a positive sense. something very much like what the NIV suggests, the reign of heaven is forcefully advancing. So isn't that a great choice? You can side with Karlstadt or Melanchthon, right? So I guess as long as it's the early Melanchthon and the really early Karlstadt, that's not too bad. Little Reformation joke there. The modern period has a whole bunch of readings, and they can't be summarized. But it was just really interesting to me. In other words, you can't just say, well, the fathers said. I mean, the ascetic reading, if you go back and look at the context, it has no connection to the context whatsoever. See? And in fact, it has no connection to the first half of the verse whatsoever. So it's really interesting. And the fathers, like anybody else, have to be read with pious and humble caution. So the lexical issues are important. They, I think, lean towards a negative sense of the terms, both verbs and the one cognate noun. There is also then the question in verse, this is Roman numeral 3 now, of the relationship between the two clauses. Now, of course, they're just linked by our little friend and, right, which is obviously flexible. Chi doesn't readily have an adversative sense, that is, but, unless one of the clauses is a positive clause and the other clause is a negative clause. And then it often and can readily mean but. So the question is, are the two clauses contrasting? So for instance, Don Carson, the great exegete up at Trinity Deerfield, he actually takes them to be contrasting clauses. But that just strikes me as being very unlikely, especially in point of what I've tried at least to illustrate in 3C. That is, just the way there's this duplication of stem, it's linked with a chi, it seems to me that there's a kind of much more likely to be a more positive parallelism between the two clauses, especially if you take the verb in the first clause as passive. And so what you have then is, and I tried at least to illustrate this, that clause A, X, that is the reign of heaven, is being wide. That is, it's being bia'ad. You know, there's that biazo, there's the stem, which intrinsically has a sense of violence most of the time. So X is being wide, and wise, that is violent people, are zeeing it. And the it, the autain, has to be the reign of heaven because it's a feminine singular accusative pronoun, and the only feminine singular noun in the context is the basileia. See? And so I just think a much stronger case can be made to take, however you understand the clauses, to take them as somewhat parallel in meaning rather than contrasting. Okay. Now, what's going on in the theological context and the exegetical context? Now, as you know, as you read the Gospel of Matthew, the conflict is hinted at but doesn't really emerge strongly until, guess what, chapter 11. You have, of course, Herod tries to kill the baby Jesus. You have John the Baptist is briefly mentioned in 4:12 as arrested. Chapter 9, there's this initial opposition to Jesus' ministry by the Pharisees, but it doesn't develop. Chapter 10, Jesus predicts opposition to the 12 as they are sent out. But it's really in chapter 11 that the opposition to Jesus begins to ratchet up, and he begins to condemn this generation, for instance, which is like children in the marketplace. And he condemns Chorazin and Bethsaida because they didn't repent when his ministry took place among them. That's all in chapter 11. So the ministry of Jesus begins to experience great opposition, beginning with the realities facing John the Baptizer himself, because the first pericope in chapter 11 is John is in Herod Antipas's prison. And he sends to Jesus and asks a question that has made Christians uncomfortable ever since, but I think it's his question. It's not a fake question. Are you the coming one, or shall we look for another? Okay. Because John announced the reign of heaven. He was its forerunner, and he's been arrested, and he's going to be executed. After answering John's question, then, in the paragraph where our little verse is embedded, this is point B now, Jesus teaches the crowds the significance of John, his identity, and his ministry. John is not just a prophet. It's true that you can regard John as a prophet, but if you stop there, you don't understand the full significance of John. He is greater than a prophet, because this is the one concerning whom it is written, and then Jesus quotes Malachi 3:1. Precisely because John is the preparer, however, those who enter under the reign of heaven that John is helping to prepare are said to be greater than John. You know, the one who is least in the reign of heaven is greater than he. That's the prior verse. Nevertheless, and I think this is what's happening theologically in this paragraph and specifically in 11:12, this royal end-time rule announced by John and manifested by Jesus is unexpected and in more ways than one. It does not come with power or force, at least irresistible force. Indeed, beginning with the days of John, arrested already in 4:12, the reign of heaven is being violently attacked. Sorry for the typo there. And violent men, chief among them Herod Antipas, are trying to snatch it away. Jesus goes on to say in the next verse, of course, and if you are willing to receive it, he is Elijah who is about to come. But then the Lord says, let the one who has ears hear. Because this manifestation of the reign of God isn't like what you were expecting. And you have to have ears to hear it and eyes to see it. So for my money, in this paragraph and other places in the Gospel of Matthew, there's very much something like what Lutherans would perhaps call a theology of the cross. A hiddenness to the reign of God as it's advancing. And the number one exhibit at this point in the narrative of that hiddenness is John the Baptizer himself. And Jesus teaching the crowds that they should not expect anything else. And there are obvious implications for life and ministry today and Christian existence under the cross as well.